The United States has welcomed immigrants from Southeast Asia for the last 60 years.
Their stories are marked by tragedy, by the loss of loved ones, of war, of sometimes years-long treks through the jungle to escape.
Erica Lee helps us learn their stories. While in Europe, democratic ideals are being challenged in a few countries, such as Hungary.
We never thought that so quickly there will be a certain political power that would want to dismantle democratic institutions.
In Poland, it's become easier to see how authoritarian interests try to stay in power.
Focus on like one major enemy and build on it.
And in Portugal,
the most important thing that the Portuguese are fighting now is for to have good jobs.
We'll look at the political challenges in Portugal, Poland, and Hungary in the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. Stay with us. As political issues dominate the national mindset in the United States leading up to the presidential election, I thought it could be interesting to look at some of the issues European countries have been grappling with. In just a bit, friends from countries whose democratic traditions only date back a generation or two will tell us what political challenges they're facing this year. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves with a look at immigration trends in the United States. As we approach 60 years since the Immigration Act of 1965 opened up the country to new arrivals from Asia, I thought it would be appropriate to revisit a conversation we had a few years back with Erica Lee. At the time we spoke, Erica was the director of the Immigration History Center at the University of Minnesota and had just written The Making of Asian America to clarify the historical record and to tell the stories of what it took to become part of the American identity.
The 1965 Immigration Act, it was signed by President Lyndon Johnson. He took the time and he brought a great number of high-profile politicians to go to Liberty Island and sign the bill there in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty and with Ellis Island in the background. And his message was that while our previous laws were really blatantly discriminatory in terms of which immigrants we allowed in, we would now be reforming our immigration laws so that they would not discriminate on nationality and national identity, but to bring in folks according to their family reunification status as well as their professional and educational skills. And in fact, the law explicitly prohibited discrimination in the granting of visas, of immigrant visas.
But the result of 1965 was today, where we have the fastest growing part of our immigrant community being Asian, 20 million Asian Americans, and there was relatively few before 1965.
Right. So in 1960, Asian Americans were just 1% of the population, but the most recent census statistics point to over 20 million, 6% of the population, and the fastest growing population in the United States.
Well, now you've written a fascinating book that takes a hard look at this based on interviews you've had with Asian immigrants, your book, The Making of Asian America. Now, when you compiled this wide-ranging set of personal stories of immigration from Asia, tell us a little bit about that. Why did you use personal stories, and what are a couple of memorable ones that illustrate how that's a very good insight into the whole community?
So as a historian, I think that the best way to engage people in imagining what it was like in the past and in understanding how that past shaped the future, I think the best way to do that is through storytelling and certainly the context and the statistics to back that up. But it's really in uncovering some of those hidden stories of long trans-Pacific journeys, of struggles building the Transcontinental Railroad, or of being the first Chinese woman in the United States, that really bring to light the conditions, the reasons why people came, the struggles that they faced, and how they had an impact on American society at the time.
Tell me a few of your favorite stories that came from east to west, from Asia to America, rather than from Europe to America.
One of my favorite discoveries was this woman named Ah Fong Moy, and she was the first recorded Chinese woman to come to the United States. And she came in 1834, which predates our understanding of the, you know, massive groups of Chinese who came during the California Gold Rush, say. So she comes, she's this lone woman in New York City. She comes on a China trade vessel. So these are the ships that are going out from the Eastern Seaboard to go to China and make their wealth importing fans and furniture and pearls and textiles. And these two New York City businessmen decide that another way they could make money is by bringing over this exotic woman from the East and putting her on display in New York City. So they rent out an exhibit hall. They dress up this showroom with all of the furniture and other things that they want to sell. And they put her on display for 8 hours a day. They charge New York City residents 50 cents to come and basically gawk at her. She represents this idea that China is this place of fascination, the exotic East, which is so different from our America. But we also know that she really faced a difficult time. She was basically the property of these New York City salesmen, and they put her on a tour throughout the United States. And this is a story of an early Asian American, you know, one could call her a pioneer, but she's been lost to history.
Erica, as you read all of these stories of different immigrants and the courage and the hardship that they endured to get here, did you find any sort of common thread, or did you find examples that really distinguish the different Asian cultures and their various immigration experience?
A little bit of both. So some of the more recent stories we've collected at the Immigration History Research Center involve those who had fled war and persecution in Southeast Asia. Their stories are marked by tragedy, by the loss of loved ones, of suffering through war, of sometimes years-long treks through the jungle to escape, and then years in Thai refugee camps before being resettled into the United States. So the refugee stories have a qualitatively different tenure than some of the immigrant stories where people plan, they choose to come. Perhaps they've come with resources. Perhaps they know somebody already here. They really are able to get started on their new lives in the United States with a little bit more of a head start than those who have fled war.
Erica Lee is a granddaughter of Chinese immigrants and teaches history at Harvard and Cambridge universities. She's also faculty director at the Schlesinger Library on the History of Women in America at Harvard. We first spoke with Erica on Travel with Rick Steves when she published The Making of Asian America. Since then, Erica's written America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States, and recently co-authored Made in Asian America, A History for Young People. You'll find links to the Immigration Stories Digital Storytelling Project, her TED Talk, and commencement address at Tufts University on her website, ericalee.org. Can give us a few of your favorite travel tips where we can get some vivid cultural experiences by visiting Korean or Filipino or Japanese and Vietnamese communities and so on.
So I think obviously San Francisco Chinatown is both the historic center of Chinese America, but remains so with the new immigration. And it's a fascinating place because you can still, and you walk the streets of Grant Avenue, you can still see both old Chinese America, and this is the community that my family is from, but also new Chinese America, which is not just mainland Chinese, but Taiwanese and from Hong Kong and Singapore. And so the vast amount of food and the diversity of food is really seen there. My other favorite place is New York City, Chinatown, which is right next door to Little Italy, of course, too. And so the mixture of those two historic neighborhoods is really a great snapshot into immigrant America and the blending of cultures.
Well, I'm going to just list a nation or a nationality, and I'll let you just in a little kind of a quick game tell me in the United States, if I was with you and you were showing me around, where I would get a vivid cultural experience relating to that culture, not in San Francisco or New York.
So, okay.
Korean. I want to learn about Korean culture. What would I do in America?
You would go to Los Angeles and you would go to Little Koreatown. But the thing with new immigration is that, unlike previous decades, immigrants are not just confined to one specific area of town, right? So certainly in the Los Angeles, the Korean community is expanding beyond just L.A., but throughout the valley.
How about Vietnamese culture?
New Orleans, but also Orange County. Orange County has the largest Vietnamese population in the country.
Now, I was just up in Juneau in Alaska, and the main square is named after a Filipino. And there's a huge, relatively huge Filipino community in Juneau. What's the background there?
Both old and new, again. So when Filipinos started migrating to the United States, and I use that term deliberately, they were not immigrants because the Philippines was a U.S. colony until World War II. Filipinos worked in the California agricultural sector. They worked in the Pacific Northwest. And in the off season, they would go up to Alaska where they were working in the salmon canneries. And so processing all of the fish there. But more recently, Filipinos are arriving in Alaska as ship hands on all of those cruise ships that are going up there.
Why are there so many Hong Kong people in Vancouver?
Because of the relationship of British colonies. So Hong Kong was a British colony until 1997, and there had long been trade routes, but also migration routes for generations that took people from Hong Kong to Canada.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Erica Lee. Her book is The Making of Asian America. Our email is radio@ricksteves.com. Amitava from Danville, California writes, I'm an immigrant from India. I came here in 1967 on a student visa, got my PhD in engineering in 73, became a U.S. citizen in 1980. Having worked in the IT industry successfully for 40 years, I'm very happy to live in the United States. How can candidates for the United States presidential election be better informed about the real positive value that educated immigrants bring to this country?
That's a million-dollar question, I think. One of the things that is happening now in terms of immigration is the concentrated focus on immigration as a bad thing, and particularly the immigration of undocumented immigrants. As Amitava is saying, the benefits, the contributions of all immigrants, and frankly, including undocumented immigrants, is being lost. So there's a lot of statistics, there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of arguments that are being expressed about immigration, good and bad. I would hope that candidates would read widely and not just in the latest study that looks at costs and crime and all of the negative things, but read more widely to look at the longer term studies. We know that, including with refugees, that there might be a increased output of spending to help integrate immigrants into the United States in the very early years, but that longitudinally, they go on to create businesses that then create jobs, that they are contributing to taxes as well as the welfare system, the Social Security system. So I think we need to encourage candidates to look broadly and think longer term rather than just at the most recent headlines and the most attention-grabbing study.
Erica, that's an inspiration. Thank you very much, and thank you for writing The Making of Asian America.
Thank you.
Professor Erica Lee is the past president of the Organization of American Historians, and she's won a number of awards for her books on immigration and Asian American history, including The Making of Asian America. We have links to Erica Lee's website and a longer version of her interview with us in this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. Controversies around immigration are just some of the issues European countries are facing as they work out what living in a democratic country looks like for them. We'll explore examples from Poland, Portugal, and Hungary next on Travel with Rick Steves.
Hello, nama saya Elizabeth Pisani, dan saya seseorang Inggris, tetapi lama di Indonesia, dan sangat suka jalan di Indonesia. Dan sekarang ini, saya jalan sama Rick Steves. That was Bahasa Indonesia, which is the national language of Indonesia. And what I was saying was, hi, my name's Elizabeth Pisani, and I'm English, but I travel a lot in Indonesia, and right now, I'm traveling with Rick Steves. Hello, nama saya Elizabeth Pisani, saya seseorang Inggris, tapi lama jalan di Indonesia. Dan sekarang ini, saya jalan bersama Rick Steves.
I remember past elections when American voters were fond of saying there's not a nickel's worth of difference between the Democratic and the Republican Party. Well, that's not the case this year. It's clear that in 2024, our country's electorate is faced with a big decision. Essentially, it's democracy versus autocracy. And one party is making the case that to get things accomplished, the old democratic status quo is a hindrance. What a lot of Americans don't realize is that Europe is engaged in pretty much the same discussion these days, and that 100 years ago, much of Europe actually elected leaders who promised to end democracy for the promise of a stronger economy, for law and order, and the pledge to make that country, whether Spain or Italy or Portugal or Germany, great again. As a historian and a travel journalist, I believe that lessons from the past and lessons from the road are particularly important considering the issues and the consequences of this year's election here in the United States. Democracies across Europe are divided like we are right here in the United States, and they're facing the same questions, the same fear of immigrants, the same claims of fake news, and the same promises from right-wing autocrats that they alone can lead their nations into a brighter future. That's why we've invited guides and colleagues from Hungary, Poland, and Portugal to join us right now on Travel with Rick Steves to share their perspectives, not on our political environment, but on their own. We're joined now by Andrea Makay, who lives in Budapest, Hungary, by Tomasz Klimek, who's from Krakow in Poland, and by Claudia da Costa, who lives in Lisbon in Portugal. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Great to be here.
So nice
Thank you for having us here.
And I am just eager to get into this conversation because each of you are living in complicated times like we are here in our democracy. Now, I was recently in Dresden in Germany, and it was a Monday, and I stumbled into a weekly confrontation on the streets. And my guide said, oh, yeah, it's Monday. So there's the people who want this, the equivalent of the MAGA, Make America Great Again kind of thinking, a crowd that was complaining about their government. And then there was a bunch of pro-democracy people on the other side of the square and a bunch of police in the middle to keep order. And this is the every Monday experience in this part of Germany. And looking at the flags and feeling the dynamic there in that crowd, I was struck by how it was very much like demonstrations I've witnessed in Turkey, I've witnessed them in Italy, and I've witnessed them in my own country. Do you feel that there's this dynamic in your country also these days? Tomasz from Poland?
So in Poland, being a democratic country, and we fought for this democracy for so long, so we kind of appreciate it even more, it is happening, yes. Sometimes exactly on the same day, in the same city, you'd have two different protests for two completely opposite causes or issues. And of course, it brings up a lot of emotions, but it's happening. And I think it's good it's happening because it is possible for both
sides. You can talk on the streets.
Yes.
So this is a way to confront these issues and find out what do we really think.
So it was difficult to talk actually in that moment because there are a lot of emotions. And I guess with those emotions, talk is difficult.
But you've already gone, you've swung to the right and now to the left. You had left, then you elected of quite a strong right-wing government, which was sort of, they put you in the same class as Turkey and Hungary and any place that was having a right-wing government. And then you elected them away.
So in Poland, you have to understand that both of those, how you call right and left, they come from the same origin. They come from the origin of solidarity. So in case of Poland, even though we do have swings, we kind of elect them back and forth, this is a very like tiny swing. It's not to all the extreme left and the extreme right. Luckily, we have nothing like this. This is slightly to the right and slightly to the left central and so on. So this is, I hope that
because
helps.
Because when I was in, you were my guide in Poland for 2 weeks as we were filming last year or 2 years ago. And this was during the time that you had your right-wing government. And I was interested in feeling what the pulse was. And it felt pretty good. I felt Poland was Poland.
Because it's going the right direction. Because of those swings are not very radical.
Right.
It just kind of continues. It changed right after your visit, actually, because in October, we swung to the left
now,
again. So
Andrea, from Hungary, you were famous in communist times as the troublemaking communist country that really had a strong freedom, a passion for freedom. And you were very difficult for Moscow, I think.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So everybody went to Hungary when they couldn't go anywhere else in the Warsaw Pact to get a little dose, a little taste of freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the case. So we really felt as a Western country for the other former communist countries. So let's say Czechoslovakia or Poland. So that was absolutely the case. And
But now you've got more than the little swing that Tomasz was talking about in Poland under Viktor Orban.
That's right.
The first European leader to endorse Donald Trump.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think what is very important to add to what Tomasz was saying just before, that in Central Europe, in former communist countries, democracy, the concept of democracy means a totally different thing. When you think about that there are countries in Europe or in other parts of the world where you have experienced hundreds of years of democracy, we don't have that. We had a very
turmoil in our history.
Right.
We are not used to how to live in a democratic country. And when Thomas was saying about how people are going out and they are, you know, fighting or they are standing by an idea and then others the opposite, many people in democracy, in these fragile modern democracies, they don't even want to do that or they don't think they can make a change because they're not used to living in democracy.
So are you saying Orban had an easier time derailing freedoms and democracy in Hungary because you didn't really understand how much power you had as a democracy?
So one point is that. The other point is that in countries where you have had hundreds of years of democracy, you do have those checks and balances that you can count on.
Right.
However, after the, let's say, end of communism in Hungary, we were so enthusiastic about the new times, freedom, that we have not put into our constitution those fundamental checks and balances because we never thought that so quickly there will be a certain political power that would want to dismantle democratic institutions.
You see, I think the brilliance of our founding fathers back in the late 1700s was to anticipate that there would be these kind of forces. Autocracy, you know, voices for elites, powerful people that would come in and derail democracy. So we had these checks and balances. And I know from my study of autocratic states, whether far left or right, you need to destroy these checks and balances. And if you look at anybody's, let's just think of whatever autocrat you can think of right now, they have a playbook. And one of those things is to get rid of the checks and balances.
That's right.
So Orban was really good at that when he took power in Hungary.
That's right. So he was the one to realize that this can be done.
Yeah.
Because there are obstacles, but he can overcome those obstacles.
So he's overcome the judiciary.
That's right.
He's overcome free press.
Yes. But on the other hand, what you can, it is definitely, you have to emphasize that it is still a democracy. Right? Which means that we have free elections, you can express your opinion. So it's a kind of a hybrid system.
So this is one of my very interesting thoughts is it is a democracy. You know, if I don't want Trump to be president, but if 50% of Americans vote for him, so be it. It's a democracy. So and in your countries also, you believe that people can still vote. And if you have Orban, it's because there's a lot of people that like what Orban has to promise.
Right, right, right. Absolutely. So that he has a very strong base of people that support him.
Yeah.
What he had mastered is to divide the population totally.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So lots of people support him. Many, many people don't support him. However, that's why I'm kind of saying it, that this is like a hybrid system.
Has he attacked the validity, the fairness of the counting of the votes?
So actually, no.
He could be voted out and he would say, okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about how Europeans are seeing the threats to democracy and how the dynamics work and how they relate to our country. We can draw those conclusions from this discussion. We're joined by Andrea McKay from Hungary, Claudia da Costa from Portugal, and Tomasz Klimek from Poland. Now, Claudia, in Portugal, your country is in a little bit different situation than Poland and Hungary, but how do you see the political dynamic in your country right now? Because you come out of a Salazar heritage, 50 years of a dictator like Franco, like not quite like Mussolini, but a fascist dictator. And in modern times, we finally got freedom in Portugal.
Yes, we have to understand that Salazar was a fascio, so a fascist, but his ideas were different from Franco, Mussolini, Hitler, all those men that were in power in the time. Salazar was one of the dictators, but we have two dictators. So Salazar was ruling the country between 1928 to 1968. And then we have the second dictator from 68 to 74.
Okay.
His name was Marcelo Caetano. He was not a sweet man, but he was different from Salazar. Salazar was the man, the dictator. So after that, in 1974, yes, we have elections and we have presidents. First of them, they were from the military. And we have a lot of people in Portugal that they still admire Salazar.
Right.
Okay? Because something that a lot of people they say is that Portugal didn't participate on the Second World War thanks to him.
Right. So that's a, a thing to brag about if you have this agenda is that you stay out of wars.
Yes, because it was dealing with the two sides of the story. Mm-hmm. Because he wanted to be neutral, of course, and this was good for us. We have to say that.
Yeah.
Of course, also for the part of the population was very difficult because Portugal, a lot of the people were starving. And now we have recently we had elections and one of the most that I find one of the biggest problems in Portugal, I think a little bit everywhere, is that people don't vote. That is, in my opinion, the worst. In Portugal, yes.
I think that's very interesting. Tomasz, what's the answer in Poland?
So actually in Poland, because we value democracy and this freedom that we had to fight for so long, so our voting rate is one of the highest in the world. Like the past election, it was 74%.
Bravo. Yeah.
And there were some places where it was reaching 90%.
Now, when we think about the promises of a right-wing wannabe autocratic government, the promises that a Salazar or a Mussolini or a Viktor Orban would make, it seems like they're similar. You've got a fear of refugees. You've got complaints about the economy. You've got promises of law and order. You've got Christian nationalism. If you were to sum up, Andrea, in Hungary, what are the promises that Orban makes that causes him to win elections?
So absolutely what is very fundamental is to understand how he can relate to the Hungarian history. So basically he kind of comes up with the idea of protecting Hungary, the integrity of the country, promising to always keep an eye on the interest of the people. If you have a look at examples of, for example, migration into Europe, and his threatening with the German or the Austrian example of how so many Muslim people were coming into the country, and he was the first one to say no to all the Syrian refugees where they wanted to come into Hungary.
Right.
So always, whatever happens, he has the kind of dynamic to just to keep an eye on what is important for the Hungarian people.
And the Hungarians were worried about immigrants coming over
and,
the border.
Yes, obviously, yes. And so that was the first kind of thing to play the cards, not to let Muslim population into a primarily Christian country, not to let anybody to take away our Hungarian culture and our values and Christianity. So that was how it started out. And as time went on, because he has been in power for 14 years now, so it's quite a long time.
Yeah.
In a way, I would say everything came handy to him. Pandemic, Ukrainian war, all of these were able to make him form a kind of an enemy. And how he is protecting everything and how he is doing everything to provide a safe environment for Hungarian people.
We're getting insider views on democracy and the threats and challenges it faces in Poland, Hungary, and Portugal right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Our guides are Tomasz Klimek, who lives in Krakow, Poland, Andrea Mackay from Budapest, Hungary, and Claudia da Costa from Lisbon, Portugal. They specialize in showing the highlights of their countries to American visitors, and they're helping us better understand the political issues they face in their countries. To me, Christian and nationalism are two different things, and it's interesting how people put that together for political purposes. Claudia, you're shaking your head, yes. What does Christian nationalism mean to a Portuguese political situation?
You know, I always go back to history, and now, well, I can go back to history and I can back to now to the reality. Salazar was a man that studied to become a priest. And then, I don't know where, there is the link, but he became a dictator.
Yeah.
So he was a very religious man.
So he got the part of the Christian vote,
people that were threatened
by non-Christian lifestyles.
Yeah, he had, like you were saying, let's make America great again. Salazar was always saying Fatima, Fado, and football.
Whoa.
So it was the three Fs of the time of Salazar.
And let's explain to people the importance of those three Fs.
Yes, Fatima, the shrine, of course. Again, important.
Super Catholic. Exactly. Super Catholic.
We still are Catholic. Yeah. We still are based in the church. The church has a lot of power.
Yeah.
That's why we had a lot of problems with the referendums for abortion and gays wedding and those kind of things. And then, obviously, football, I think, in Europe, but Portugal is like, Cristiano Ronaldo is kind of a god for the Portuguese.
This is interesting. I saw the same thing with Maradona in Naples, in the poor parts of Italy. you know, the soccer star was the great equalizer.
Sure.
You know, the poor city could actually have the same number of people on the field as the rich city, and they could get equal because they had the star.
And then just the last F, Fado, I think is because, again, he was a patriot. So Portugal is important. Traditions are important.
Fado is the traditional music. Tomasz, what about Christian nationalism in Poland, where you have actually had a recent pope come from?
So actually in Poland, situation is a little bit different. Poland has been always very predominantly Catholic country, 96% Catholic, which is a number is difficult to find elsewhere.
Right.
But in Poland, especially under the communism and in those difficult times as Polish history is full of, the church was always supportive of people. So going to church under the communism was a sort of side of rebel. I know people who are atheists and they were going to church on Sunday, like to show
atheists
the middle finger.
Atheists would show their middle finger by not having a brunch, but by going to church mass on Sunday.
And also after the church Sunday, the intellectuals will meet at the end and discuss important things. So it was a place to be. So this religion,
a symbolic statement.
It was a very symbolic statement.
Government.
Exactly. Against, not the government, against the regime, against the communism.
Regime. I gotcha. Yeah.
So it's still very powerful. Of course, numbers are dropping, which is always happening when you get more money, the richer the country gets, the religion kind of drops down, and we see it, but still it's a very slow process, and still religion is important, and none of those directions of the swing would dare to kind of touch that, because one of the prime ministers from the central left-wing party, actually just before the elections, he took official church marriage just to be able to
credentials for the
Christian electorate. So you see, it's a little bit of a different side.
There's more in just a moment on the issues Andrea, Claudia, and Tomasz are facing in their countries and what it's been like lately to promote democratic ideals in Hungary, Portugal, and Poland. You're listening to Travel with Rick Steves. Portugal has only had a multi-party democracy since 1974, after some four decades under an autocratic dictatorship. Hungary was recently called an electoral autocracy by the European Parliament because of Viktor Orbán's lock on the government. While recent elections in Poland swapped control of its government to an anti-authoritarian party by a thin margin. We're getting the views of tour guide friends of mine right now on Travel with Rick Steves on political trends in their countries. Claudia da Costa comes to us from Lisbon in Portugal. Tomasz Klimek lives in Krakow in Poland. And Andrea Makay is from Budapest, Hungary. This is so fascinating to compare the realities that all of us who care about our societies, our neighborhoods, our freedom, have to deal with. And it's not easy. It's complicated. And we've learned a lot from history. We're learning a lot from each other as we go through these challenges. I'm very curious because this is a big issue in the United States. In your countries, where do you think most people get their news in order to make their political decisions?
Claudia. Well, in Portugal, we have still a lot of newspapers, but unfortunately, most of the newspapers are what we call it sensationalist. And then radio as well.
But so when you say sensationalist, does that mean made very exciting to sell more,
exactly,
and it has a political agenda, so this would be famous as a right-wing newspaper and this would be a left-wing newspaper?
Exactly.
And what is the power of social media to shape people's political perspectives in Poland, in Portugal?
A big power. But I think it's important for everyone, not only the Portuguese. We can read right, left-wing newspapers, but we have to think with our heads. So it's our choice, okay?
That's what I learned in Central America. Anybody who really wanted to know, they would buy the right-wing paper and the left-wing paper, and they would then have to digest that together. Because a person on the left is just as naive as a person on the right if their whole viewpoint is shaped by media that they agree with. Tomasz, in Poland, how do people get their news and what shapes their political perspectives?
So Poland is no different. It's very much divided and polarized. And just to give you an example, the previous parliament elections, there were two candidates from the opposite sides, and there was 50.2 to 49.8. So you see the division.
It's so like, that was the recent election that was so a tidal change in Poland.
The recent presidential election, yeah. So like one before, but still it shows you kind of how it is. So the same, no different with the news. So you have this like more conservative type of media and more liberal and like still reading on the same event on those two
like
wings.
Like two different events.
You are reading about two different worlds.
Is there no middle of the road media?
There is actually one party that shaped the actual political scene, and they call themselves Third Road, literally, because they want to do something in between.
Third Road.
And this is like a huge hope. And
see, we have that in our society, mm-hmm. but we have a different kind of government because we're a two-party system, essentially. And if you vote for something you might agree with more, you could be helping the enemy politically. So you're perplexed. But in a parliamentary system like I think you've got, you have many different parties.
Yes.
And then nobody's going to get the majority. So they have to have a coalition. Is that
they
right?
have to coalition. So even though technically this governing like more central right party won,
yeah.
but they couldn't form a coalition. So eventually they have to give power away. So this is also the beauty of democracy, that
yeah.
even if you are a winner, you still cannot rule.
In Poland, what's the power of social media?
Social media has amazing power, and kind of naturally, more of this power goes to this central left side, as this more conservative part is more involved in internet and Facebook and other social media.
So who benefits from it?
So the central left sort of benefits more from it because the social media is generally...
favors the left in your society.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
I'm not sure what it is in our society, but that's a very important point. Mm-hmm. Andrea, in Hungary, what news shapes people's perspectives?
Yes, so basically comparing to what Claudia and Thomas was mentioning, it's very, very different in Hungary because we do know how powerful news are, how powerful radio, the whole media. In Hungary, we are at the situation now that basically there is a very high percentage of the media is in the hand of the government. So let's say you live in a little village, you don't have, let's say, internet, or even if you have internet, you don't read on the internet. You just switch on the national television, number one channel, number two channel, several other channels, and you always find the same kind of propaganda of the government.
So then the government has really taken over the official
absolutely,
media.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a very high percentage of the media is owned by the government. And then you buy a newspaper, let's say, and then you read the same thing. Then you even buy your little gossip newspaper where you want to read about your, let's say, actor and actress and whatever. And little articles are about also explaining to you the propaganda. And that's very disproportionate.
And this is interesting in the United States because a lot of American consumers of news don't understand who owns their small town newspaper. But our small town newspapers have been pretty much owned by big corporate interests with a political agenda. And it's kind of tricky, but it shapes people's opinions without people even realizing that.
Yes.
And you're saying in Hungary you have that, but everybody realizes it.
Yes, well, they do realize it. But of course, we also have to admit that there are many people that don't look behind the scenes. They don't also understand it.
So the less sophisticated consumers of news would buy the Orbán line.
Of course. And they would not understand that it's all coming from the same sources.
But you're not so naive. I'm talking right now to a person from Hungary who knows the difference. How do you do that?
Yes. Well, I mean, basically, there are many, many people that would like to have their news from both sides. And also, yeah. I would definitely emphasize that it's very important, again, not to just try to say that everything that they do is bad.
Right.
So we have to get the information. We have to analyze it and come up with our conclusion.
You are great. And is the social media very strong in yours? Is it controlled by the government?
No. On social media, you can post anything you want. We have all sorts of groups and Facebook and Instagram and all over. You can write about what you want. You can have anti-governmental posts. You can do that. You can do that because it is still a democracy. There is no doubt about that. It's very important to emphasize that. But on the other hand, there is a much smaller percentage of the media that gives way to what the, let's say, opposition parties would like to communicate to the people.
Sometimes that's the easier choice for them to make. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking democracy and divided societies and what's going on politically in Europe now, so perhaps we can better understand what's going on in our country. You can learn so much from history, and you can learn so much by traveling and talking to people who have the same challenges in their society that we have today in ours. Our guests are Andrea Mackay from Budapest in Hungary, Claudia da Costa from Lisbon in Portugal, and Tomasz Klimek from Krakow in Poland. If you were a wannabe autocrat in your country and you wanted to, you knew what the answers were, you said, hey, democracy is old news. I know the answer, only I can fix it. And you needed to win the election. Andrea, how would you get elected in Hungary? What fears would you capitalize on in your society to get elected?
If it would be, let's say, today, I would definitely just say practically that we don't want to send all our husbands and sons and fathers to the war, and I'm going to protect every single citizen of Hungary not to be sent over to the Ukrainian war and fight, because that's kind of a threat that and everybody would understand and say, oh, well, I'm going to vote for that person who is promising that we are never going to get involved in that war.
And if you were to assess how Orban has capitalized on people's fears, how did he fearmonger?
As time came on, first it was the migrants, then it was the pandemic, how he is the only one can protect the people, how if there was a left-wing government, then just everybody would die. And then it continued on, of course, with the Ukrainian war. So everything that happens, you just have to plant the fear in the head of the people. And then they're going to say, okay, these are turbulent times. We better stick to that person that we already have. Or if it was not the case, then we would better vote for that person who is promising us that nothing is going to change.
I gotcha. Tomasz from Poland, how would you capitalize on, not how would you personally, but if you just wanted power, what trick would you play on your people to get them to vote for you?
It's a very difficult question. I personally feel kind of weird even answering that.
Yeah.
But when I was listening to Andrea's previous comments, those are actually the current situation that is happening, okay? So if there was a case of immigrants, there would be kind of like, because you always have to be fear number one. You cannot put too many because then it's going to disperse. So you have to focus on like one major enemy, okay? And build on it.
Right.
So you would have to decide what would be the biggest enemy at that point, okay, of this campaign, of your speech and so on, because
right.
It is also changing throughout the time.
Yeah.
But kind of ironically, if I can just comment, so this kind of enemy that I'm saying in between the brackets now, the refugees, but when the war in the Ukraine broke out, 4.2 million Ukrainians went over to Poland and we opened them with the open arms. And this sort of previous enemy became something that united Poland, and regardless of your political opinion, everyone was supportive of that.
Wow.
People were hosting them, driving them from the border. So what I'm trying to say that even this enemy that is presented as an enemy, at certain point, if you plan it well, it can become something that is uniting us as a nation. And this is something that united Poland, which is amazing, and no one was expecting it, to be honest.
That is quite astounding. Claudia.
In Portugal, the situation is much different, as my friends and colleagues are talking about. I think the most important thing that the Portuguese are fighting now is for to have good jobs. A lot of young people are leaving the country because the salaries are bad. So, and I'm talking about those who finish their university, so they have university degrees. And one of the fears, and that's why I think that party's extreme right party is becoming popular, is because that party is saying they are taking their jobs. Who are they? Foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
People that are not from Portugal, and they just come to find better conditions of living. So I would say that the worst fear right now for the Portuguese is work. And good salaries. We are
jobs.
Fighting for
jobs,
good
jobs.
Yeah.
And when you see people, when you say people might come in and take these jobs, would they be poor people coming in from the south or highly educated people coming in?
Both. In fact, we have both.
Uh-huh.
Because we also have, well, this is a little strange because we say we don't want our qualified young people leave the country, such as doctors and nurses, but they do because the salaries are bad. So we are hiring qualified people from other countries. And this is kind of weird. Why we don't raise the salaries for the Portuguese to stay and not having others from other countries that they are okay with the salaries that we offered in Portugal.
So many interesting, related but not always the same issues that are driving these political discussions. We're looking at the pressures on democracy in Europe right now on Travel with Rick Steves. For perspectives on what's influencing the political process there, our guides are Claudia da Costa from Lisbon, Portugal, Tomasz Klimek from Krakow, Poland, and Andrei Makay from Budapest, Hungary. We have links to our guests with each week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. I'm just very curious about how you see your future in your country when it comes to democracy. Just give me a yes or no answer. 10 years from now, will your country have a democracy, a strong democracy, or will it have opted for autocracy at the expense of much of the democracy? Claudia, in Portugal.
I believe in Portugal. I'm pretty sure that we will have a democracy in 10 years.
And many of you can remember living under the fascist government.
Yeah, because I think it's too recent what we lived, especially women, was very tough. My mom, my grandma, well, all women in the time. And I don't think, even if there is people that are voting for other kind of parties that they believe they can change the world or Portugal, I still believe that we will live in a democracy in 1 to 10 years, 20 years from now.
Nice. Tomasz, in Poland.
I believe in democracy. I think we'll stay there, basing on the fact that, first of all, we fought for it for so long, for freedom and for being able to be a democratic country. It hasn't been that long, so we still kind of appreciate it. We don't take it for granted. It is shown by our high voting rate. And those swings that are happening are actually good for democracy in
that's,
a way.
That's progress.
Healthy.
Yeah.
You should change it if
so
it
too.
Stays too long.
I like the pendulum. No. I just don't like the radical pendulum.
Yeah.
Andrea, from Hungary, and that's the country that I think it's fair to say has the most entrenched and successful far-right government in Europe right now.
That's right. But what I would like to kind of say about this is that I'm 100% sure that there will be democracy. We have overcome, starting from the Mongolians, the Turks, the Habsburg Empire, Soviet ruling, communism, we are still here. And I think it's a learning process for us to really learn how to live in a democratic country. And we learn it the hard way, that's 100% sure, but there will be democracy, and I'm absolutely certain about that.
That is very hopeful, and it sounds like you know better than I do Hungary's future, so I hope you are right. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Andrei Makay from Hungary, Claudia da Costa from Portugal, and Tomasz Klimek from Poland. And I want to finish our discussion just to ask you guys, when you look at the United States, what do you see and what would you like to say to us as we prepare to vote, given the experience you have in your country? Tomasz from Poland.
So I would say don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. This is still democracy. You're in a democratic country. Don't let anyone tell you that something that is happening could be a threat or could be and change it into an enemy for you, because actually it could be the opposite. As it happened in Poland, the idea of the refugees became something that united us as we accepted over those 4.2 million Ukrainian refugees that were looking some peace and hope in our country. And it united us. It was a surprise. No one knew about it. No one could plan it. But looking at it from perspective, I would say don't be afraid and don't let present certain things as an enemy.
So what you could be encouraged to be afraid of could actually be your society's friend.
Exactly.
Claudia from Portugal.
Well, what I will say is that first you have to think what you are doing. You have to understand the consequences of you will do, okay? So after you know and you really understand what this is going to be the consequence for you, for your future, for your family, for your life, then if you vote, if you choose according to what you think, but when I say what you think in a general picture. Don't only think about yourself, but think in a general picture. Think on the consequence of what you do in the future.
I like that. Not me today, but us tomorrow.
Exactly.
Andrea from Hungary.
So I would say that United States is always a symbol of democracy. So it's an example to the world what to do, how to think, how to make a decision. And I think it's very, very important because, again, you have been living in democracy always, let's say. So this is natural for you. And I'm not saying that you should wake up every morning and say thanks to God that you live in a democratic country, but don't take it for granted. And everybody should realize that they do make a difference. So if those kind of, let's say, percentage of how many people vote in the U.S. would be similar to what Thomas was saying in Poland, that would be a very, very important step to live with your democratic rights. That you, and as an individual, make a difference. You can make a difference.
You guys, I am so thankful for this discussion. Thank you all very much. And it'd be great to meet again in a few years and compare notes again. And hopefully we have lots of good news for our democracies.
I hope in 10 years we will see here and we see for all of us, we live in a democracy.
Amen. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Thank you for having us.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You'll find more about our guests at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
My Facebook friends are a fun community of curious travelers, and you're invited to join in. To stow away with me in my work, play, politics, philanthropy, and travels, follow me at Rick Steves on Facebook.